This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Welcome to all of you tonight. Thank you for coming out to Libri. This is... Well, usually I give an announcement for what the following lecture is going to be, but this is the last one this term, so there is, yeah, we have no idea what the next lecture is going to be, actually. So, yeah, we'll need to get on that soon. But anyway, welcome to Libri. Thank you for coming out on our last lecture of the term. And braving the cold. Got cold again for some reason. Yeah, so this was my original title, Birds of the Kingdom Part 2, The Brains and Brawn of Migration, and as I was preparing it, it wasn't the right title. So, first part of the title is the same, it is still Birds of the Kingdom Part 2, but The Power and Vulnerability of Migration seemed to be a more appropriate title for this topic, so glad you came anyway. I don't know if you wouldn't have come if you'd known the title was changed, but I tricked you. So this is the second in a series. I'm not sure how long this series will be, but this is part two. Part one was last term, and that was focusing on the phenomenon of flight, the unlikely thing it is that anything can fly at all. So we talked a lot about what a bird's body needs to be and do in order to stay airborne. This lecture, in a sense, is an extension of part one, in that to migrate is one of the most amazing things that flight enables the bird to do. And so this is kind of like an extended tangent from the first lecture, but something that's so significant in terms of understanding birds on this planet that it's worth a lot more than a lecture. This is a very, very complex and diverse topic, and apologies to anyone who actually really knows a lot about this, any ornithologists in the house or listening to the podcast. If you feel that I'm oversimplifying things, you're not wrong, because my hope is just to give, you know, people that maybe aren't ornithologists a glimpse of the complexity of it, and to invite you into a place of wonder as we observe it. So, I'll just say a little bit word about myself. I love to watch birds. I've been a bird watcher for a long time. I like to, ever since I was a kid, I like to draw and paint birds, and I like to carve birds. Now, my brother Tim is a legit bird biologist. He lives down on the coast of Georgia and does a lot of research with migratory birds. He's the main one I'm afraid of offending, you know. And I've picked his brains quite a bit. He actually, one of the books I'm using tonight was a gift from him, which I really appreciate. Anyway, I'm going to start with a passage from the book of Job, chapter 39. Joshua, my colleague, did a lecture on Job last week. And it was sort of an interesting connection there. This is the part of the book of Job where God is questioning Job, where God actually shows up and responds, not so much by answering Job's direct questions, but by asking Job questions, and not with the purpose of getting answers from Job, but really a series of questions that are designed to get Job to reflect humbly on who he is and who God is, and to come away with an appropriate sense of his own smallness in relationship to God. God asked Job this question. Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle soar at your command or build its nest on high? It dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is its stronghold. And then the Lord continues to... Sadly, he moves his questions away from birds. But so it's hard to say whether or not the phrase "spread its wings toward the south" is a reference to hawks migrating. It could be. We have no idea. Many birds of prey in the Middle East do migrate south in the wintertime. And there seems to have been some, among ancient people, some awareness of that birds were, you know, departing and then coming back. But we don't really know exactly, at least I don't really know exactly what the writer of Job is getting at here. But in any case, God is making it clear that where the hawk decides to go is both outside of Job's control and beyond his abilities to understand. It's not by Job's wisdom that the hawk does anything. That is the point of the question. So it also indicates that whoever wrote the book of Job had watched hawks and probably wondered where do they go. If they spread their wings toward the south, that's a start, but it's not a very precise understanding of where birds go. So the writer of Job is making the point that where birds go is God's business. And in fact, it's so much God's business that Job, with his limited knowledge and his technical resources, would be foolish to try to answer the question. And that's the whole point of that section of Job. It would be foolish for him to try to answer the questions. He just needs to listen and confess that he has no answer. Bird migration is, I think, one of the most stunning wonders of God's creation. Hawks aren't even the beginning of it. This is a picture. I'm not sure where this picture is taken, but this is a typical fall migration picture, looking straight up in the sky at a bunch of soaring hawks that are circling around, and this is called a kettle, where you have a bunch of them circling around, catching the warm thermal waves off the ground, gaining altitude higher and higher, and then they'll fly off in different directions or gradually work their way south. Hawks are not particularly strong migrators compared to many other birds. We know a lot more than the writer of Job did, which is wonderful, but our understanding of bird migration is still rapidly growing area of knowledge. We'll learn about some important discoveries that were only made relatively recently, and there's a lot that scientists have yet to discover about birds and their migration patterns. Even if we learn everything there is to learn, which we won't, I think bird migration will always be God's business. This is kind of like the lesson we take from Job. This is actually, it actually is by his wisdom that the hawk spreads its wings and heads south. It's not by my wisdom, it's not by Job's wisdom, but it is by God's wisdom. And it's by his wisdom that he designed the entire complex system into which migration fits. So everything there is to know about bird biology, bird metabolism, reproduction, global seasonal changes, geography, oceans, weather, climate, all of that is an incredibly complex system into which bird migration fits and works. So before we jump into some of these topics, a word about the kind of thing that we're doing tonight. This is a little bit of an overlap with my first bird lecture, just to give you a sense of what we're doing and not doing tonight. Theologians of the Reformation talked about two books of God's creation. This is something we talk about a lot in the Brie. It's a helpful image. There's two books, two ways in which God has revealed himself to us. The first book is the book of Scripture, the literal book, which is sometimes referred to as special revelation, the way that God has shown himself in the Bible, which is very particular and very necessary if we're going to understand who the Lord is. The second book is the book of creation, a figurative book. It's not a literal book, but it's the entire created world around us. And this is sometimes an aspect of what people call general revelation, the kind of revelation that's accessible to anyone who, regardless of what they believe about the Bible, anybody can look around them at creation. So to seek out the works of the Lord by investigating creation, I think, is as spiritual a discipline as searching the Scriptures. They are two completely interdependent practices. It shouldn't be done to the neglect of Scripture, but it's as spiritual a discipline to look for the hand of God in creation as it is to search the scriptures. The Bible itself tells us to engage in the spiritual discipline of learning from creation. That's one reason we should do it. We're actually told to in the Bible. We're told that we'll learn things about God's power and his wisdom by looking and listening and tasting and touching and smelling. Think of Romans 1, think of Psalm 19, and many other passages that tell us, like, look around you. Even if the Bible doesn't tell us explicitly to look around us, very often, even in Jesus' words, he's using creational metaphors, and he's saying things that would only make sense if we were looking around us, even if he doesn't directly make the command. So the two books are mutually interpreting. They shed light on each other. I need creation to rightly read Scripture. Nobody can read Scripture rightly in a box, you know, without looking at anything else, I don't think. But we also need Scripture to rightly read creation. There's no guarantee that I will discern everything I need to discern about who God is just by looking at creation. So that's why the Reformers talked about these two books. It's important to hold both of them all the time. So tonight, we're going to be mostly looking at the book of creation, while holding the Bible in the other hand, so to speak. This is the sort of thing I was trying to do last time, and I'll probably, if I ever do another bird lecture, I'll probably introduce it the same way, because it's important to understand what we're doing. We never let go of the Bible. It's still the way in which we understand everything. And yet, we're looking mostly at the book of creation. I'll mention two things that we will not be doing. First of all, we will not be combing the scriptures for references to bird migration. That is not... I think I found the only one, you know, in Job. That's probably not true. We will mostly be investigating the phenomenon of migration itself, and then, given what we know, given who we know God to be, ask the question, can this give us a fuller picture of God as the maker and keeper of all things? So that's the kind of goal. I will also not be using creation to find proofs for God being real. That's not my goal tonight either. The natural world is more than a body of evidence for God's existence. It does point to God in a host of ways. But if we view it only as a means to make arguments for God's existence, we will actually not observe or investigate deeply enough into creation itself. This is something that I'm afraid many Christians sort of fall into this trap. Instead, I'm basically starting with a belief in God the Creator that's absolutely informed by the Bible. And I'm asking the question, what more can we learn about what this God is like, his loves, his sensibilities, in a sense, his creative tendencies is something that I feel like I'm looking for here. Starting with a belief in God and looking at this phenomenon of bird migration, what can we learn about his creative tendencies? I think we will learn things about God which resonate with what he tells us about himself in Scripture, even though Scripture does not address our topic in any depth. So, my outline here, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a sense of where we're going. What is migration? The power of birds, how do they do it? And that's a very complicated question. And then the vulnerability of birds, migration as a window into a crisis. That's sort of the three main sections we're working on. Starting off with what is migration? I want to look at some local birds. For those of you who likes to watch birds, who has a bird feeder and has an interest? Okay, awesome. Yeah. So I thought we'd start with talking about some birds that probably most of you will recognize. What is migration, though? Simply, it's the movement of a population of creature, fish, mammal, bird, insect, even people, from one location to another. So relocation of a whole population. People migrate. Of course, many birds, species all over the globe, relocate seasonally. Whole populations move in a seasonal way. Literally billions and billions of birds relocating seasonally. But they migrate different distances. They migrate to different locations depending on the species of bird. And migration science, I'm going to say it over and over again, is a really complicated field. And so I'm just sort of skipping off the surface here in a lot of ways. But to look at some of our local birds, anyone who pays close attention to birds in Massachusetts will notice that some birds can be seen year-round. You can spot a chickadee and a cardinal seen here on the same bird feeder. Any day of the year you want in Massachusetts, if you look long enough, you could see a chickadee and a cardinal. Even if some individual chickadees and cardinals may migrate short distances in the wintertime, there will always be chickadees and cardinals around because they're a species that is suited for both winter and summer weather. In other words, what that means is they can find food in the wintertime in the same regions in which they can breed and raise their young in the spring and summer. Those things overlap. The same goes for a whole bunch of other birds that will come to your feeder. Blue jays, nuthatches, juncos, many kinds of sparrows, woodpeckers, mourning doves, house finches. For some of you, those you may have actual images of birds coming to mind when I name those things. Tufted titmice, that's another one. These are all species that you would see at your bird feeder normally in the wintertime. Here's a bird you might not see at your bird feeder, which is one of the more beautiful birds that we have. not a very common one to see. This is a Bohemian waxwing. They're another bird that hangs around a lot in the winter, mostly by feeding on crabapples and berries and things that are still hanging onto trees. Cedar waxwing is sort of a smaller cousin of the Bohemian waxwing, which is much more common. You can see those flying around in flocks here. But this is just slightly more spectacular bird. But this is not the case for many birds. We've just been talking about the birds that stick around. Some birds, their food source disappears when the weather gets cold. So the attentive bird lover will notice that as fall settles in, certain species of birds just disappear and then reappear the following spring. If you think of red-winged blackbirds, I'm starting to hear them again, actually, but they're not around when the winter's the coldest. And then they sort of come back. They're one of the early ones to come back. Bluebirds, another one that tend to come back very early. You won't see them in the dead of winter, but very early spring you'll start to see them. Every kind of warbler, the tiny little guys that are mostly yellow, there's many, many varieties. They don't come back till a bit later. Orioles, beautiful orange and black birds, hummingbirds, grosbeaks, all these other ones. These are birds that feed on things that disappear in the winter, like flying insects, various plants, flower nectar in the case of hummingbirds. Also, some birds depend on open water, and when water freezes, they either have to go south or they become more salt water. They go towards the ocean where there's more open water. That's the case with a lot of herons and egrets and things like that. But mostly we're talking about birds that fly, that migrate south to where there's food. Okay, I told you it was complicated. Other birds appear in Massachusetts only when it gets really cold. What's going on there? These species spend their summers much further north, some in the high Arctic, and they migrate south to New England because of how warm it is here in the winter. This is particularly true for certain owls and some waterfowl, sea ducks, the ducks you see on the ocean. The coast of Massachusetts in January and February is actually a really good place to look for all kinds of species of diving sea ducks. So we're just going to go through a couple of these right now. Beautiful creatures. This is a bufflehead. It's one of the smallest ducks that we have. That's one of them on the piano there, too. An eider. Common eider. This is a very common duck to see in the wintertime here off the coast. Swimming in big flocks. It's called a raft when you see a huge bunch of ducks on the water. And they're just floating around on the high seas. In sub-zero temperatures, yeah. It's the reason why eiderdown is warm, cozy kind of feather. Harlequin ducks. These are ducks that like the rocks, like the surf sort of pounding around the rocks, and they dive and find their food in sort of turbulent water. Here's a whole flock of them. Every once in a while, this only happened once for me, looking out with a spotting scope on the ocean, looking at a whole raft of common eider, which are very normal to see, every once in a while there's like a misfit in the group. And it was a king eider, which is very, very, very unusual to see. Spectacular bird from the high Arctic. Occasionally you see them off the coast of Massachusetts. Only in the dead of winter. bird watching for sea ducks in Massachusetts is a very, very cold experience. It's something that you should definitely do if you ever get a chance, but it's if you like a challenge, it's one of the coldest experiences I've ever had. But also, if you go to the North Shore of Massachusetts to a place called Plum Island, anywhere where there's open grassland in the wintertime or salt marshes, you're likely to see short-eared owls and maybe even snowy owls. Short-eared owls and snowy owls are actually both diurnal. They both hunt during the daytime, unlike a lot of other owls, so you actually see them. You can see them out in the open. Logan Airport is actually a place where snowy owls tend to go because it resembles tundra. Basically, they go and they hunt for mice and everything. Okay, so that's birds that arrive here and spend their winters here because of how warm it is. If you travel to the tropics in the wintertime, though, say Costa Rica or maybe the rainforest in Colombia or something like that, you would see hundreds and hundreds of species that stay put there year-round, right? Those are tropical or subtropical birds that they stay in one place mostly. But you could also see some of our ordinary birds from the summertime show up there in the wintertime. So some fairly common birds. This is a wood thrush. We hear these in the summer. You're more likely to hear it than see it. I'm going to play you a recording of a wood thrush song. Hopefully it will be recognizable to some of you. Hopefully it will be loud enough too. I'm just going to turn it way up. It's one of the most beautiful bird songs, I think. This is the Sibley field guide. So, yeah. So that is a very common thing to hear in the afternoons in the woods. It sort of echoes out of the woods, and you usually don't get a good look at a wood thrush, but they're singing constantly. Beautiful bird, related to robin. They're one of the American robin's closest relatives. They're another kind of thrush. In fact, young robins look a lot like a wood thrush because they have a spotted breast just like the wood thrush. gone on a tangent here. But as you can see, a lot of the images I'm showing you today are an image of the bird, its name, and then a migratory map to see what these birds actually do. So wood thrush, not an uncommon bird to see here in the summer times, but when it starts to get cold, they migrate, depending on where they are, to different places in Central America. So birds around here migrate roughly to Panama. And as you can see, they go to different, like Nicaragua, a couple of other different Central American countries. And they spend their winters there hopping around in coffee plantations alongside tropical birds. So hopefully that just gives you a sense of how multifaceted this topic is. It's just kind of all over the place. Every bird species is different. Of the birds that do migrate, some birds migrate relatively short distances. Some migrate enormous distances, gradually, you know, step by step in little hops, but they wind up, you know, very far away. Some migrate enormous distances all at once. And some populations within a species migrate in a different way than other members of the same species. So it's all over the place. I'm going to talk about some notable discoveries in migration science. This is the real reason why you came. However amazing the story of birds is, it's sort of paralleled by another amazing story, which is the story of all the people who discovered what we now know about migration. It's a story about insatiable human curiosity, ingenuity, and perseverance, and extreme nerdiness. Bird migration science is a challenging field. It's very, very hard to find out where a bird is going when it flies over your head at 50 miles an hour over the horizon. How would you know? How would you know where that bird is going? How would you find out where it was headed? How would you know where it was 10 minutes later, let alone a month later or 6 months later or a year later. Even if you knew where a bird was headed, how would you know if it ever got there? When did it get there? By what route did it get there? Did it travel alone or in a whole flock of its kind? None of these questions are remotely answerable without really advanced technology. There's no way, this is just a joke, there's no way you could ever find out. We'd be in the same position as Job. Being like, I don't know. So the plot of the story is in large part driven by technological innovations that people have made in their eagerness to find out, like, what are birds up to? Like, what are they doing? How do they do what they're doing? Where are they going? I'll give you, I'll just recommend this book to you if you're interested. It's called Flight Paths by Rebecca Heisman. How a passionate and quirky group of pioneering scientists solved the mystery of bird migration. I'm not sure they solved the mystery of bird migration, but they did a lot along that path. This is a really fun, really, really fun book about all the different ways that people have tried to find out. But I'll give you a little bit of a blitz through some of these innovations. So one of the early indications going way back into ancient times, and certainly in native cultures in this country and in other places, people were aware that birds were migrating. Right? This was not like a shocker. But not everybody was aware, or really nobody was aware of exactly where are they going and how far away are they going. In Germany in 1822, first of all, I'll show you this picture. This is a white stork. This is a very common bird in Europe to see. It's the birds you see, like, making gigantic nests on top of chimneys and stuff in Europe. They don't deliver babies, but they do make these big nests. In 1822, a German farmer shot and killed a white stork on his farm, only to discover that it already had a 30-inch fragment of spear sticking through its neck. The spear was later identified as coming from Central Africa. Wow. So people thought, you know, people began to think and realize, storks must travel really, really, really far away, all the way to sub-Saharan Africa for this stork to have wound up with it. Anyway, so this bird, it's called, I don't speak German, but it has a German name, which basically means the arrow stork. It was taxidermied and is now in a museum, and that's it.
Oh, so, my
goodness. Field stork? Arrow stork? It's hard to imagine how it flew or survived or even got around or did anything with that, but that's what it was.
Wait, so that's it, taxidermy.
Yes, that's the one bird. That's not a replica. Yeah. That's the actual bird. Yeah.
Bird.
Yeah. Wow. You can travel to Germany and see it if you really want to. the arrow stork did not provide much information about stork migration, but it was an indicator that raised more questions than it answered, obviously. But many, many innovations in tracking the movement of birds followed. So one of the earliest methods of tracking migration, which is still really widespread today, and it's one of the lowest tech ways to do it, is bird banding. Banding is a practice of carefully putting on these little fitted rings or bands on the legs of birds. You can see here there's a whole range of different sizes depending on the kind of bird you're banding, so you don't hurt. The idea is that it's not going to slip off the foot of the bird, but it's also not constricting the leg at all, so it's supposed to be able to slide nicely up and down the leg of a bird. This is a common yellow throat. It's kind of warbler that's very common here in the summertime. This is an oyster catcher, American oyster catcher, which is one of the birds that my brother Tim studies on the coast of Georgia. But each band that you put on a bird has a specific identifying number that marks that bird as unique and where it was banded. And before a banded bird is released, the biologist will take the weight of the bird, determine the sex of the bird, the basic health of the bird. All of that will be recorded on a database. Some birds are given special colored bands that you can actually identify from a distance. You can either see the numbers or you can see a pattern of colored bands that can indicate to somebody far away where it was banded. So you say, oh, that's a Georgia bird. Oh, that's a South Carolina bird, without having to catch the bird again. And that's the challenge. So banding has been an amazing source of information all over the continent and all over the world, actually, for many, many years. It's a huge amount of work. It depends on a lot of things working just right. People being able to catch the birds in the first place. It's not a simple thing, necessarily. The birds have to survive for a while after they've been released. For smaller birds, this is usually done. They're usually caught by hanging very fine mesh, sort of nylon mesh. They're called mist nets, and they're basically invisible to a bird when they're hanging. And you usually would set these nets up in a place where you know birds are going to be flying through. And then you need to check them routinely so that a bird isn't hanging in the net for too long. And then you band it, you do your measurements, and then you release it. That's usually how people catch smaller birds like songbirds. Ideally, scientists recapture the same bird with the banding information intact, and then or they see a bird from a distance and they can identify it, and then they can access the data that you've already entered, and then that adds to the information about that bird. So if a bird is banded in Massachusetts and then it's recaptured and identified in Nicaragua, you've learned something, right? Oh, this is a Massachusetts bird. This was banded 3 months ago off the coast of Massachusetts. So it depends on a shared database that can be accessed and added to by people from different countries and continents. It takes real cooperation. All of this science takes cooperation between people of different countries because migratory birds do not respect borders, of course. And they just careen off across the globe. And if you really want to know what's happening to a species of bird, you need to be in cooperation with other people. But banding is really, it's quite a reliable and good way. It takes a lot of people. It takes a lot of man and woman power to make it happen. For every 1,000 birds you band and release, relatively few of them will be recaptured. So it's not like super efficient. but we learn a lot about birds through banding. This is just kind of like a little bit of a window into some of the other technologies. So in World War II, there were radar technicians. Some of them were in the British Navy. Some of them were American Navy officers who were in charge of radar on ships on the ocean. They kept seeing these, what they called ghost images, appearing on the radar screens. Large but indistinct shapes that would sort of move in and out of focus and disappear. And nowhere near as distinct an image on the radar screen as a boat or plane would be. And so for a long time, people didn't know what these were. Finally, some very smart technicians realized that the radar was picking up on large flocks of migrating birds at night. So huge flocks of birds migrating over the ocean at night. Nobody had witnessed that before, but it was the radar could actually pick it up. And because it was a flock of birds moving and it wasn't one solid object, it appeared sort of in this sort of ghostly image on the radar screen. More recently, a lot more data has been collected using weather radar. So there's some people that have done a lot of more sort of global analysis of how many birds are migrating by looking at radar images that are usually used for tracking weather. Ornithologists, sort of in the mid part of the 20th century, back in the 50s and 60s, realized that many songbirds do the bulk of their migrating at night in large groups. And two different methods of counting passing birds developed as a result. This sounds really weird and inefficient and crazy, but this is like people were really trying to find out something. And moon watching observations. So it's the middle of a black night. There's thousands and thousands of birds careening overhead that you can't see. One of the only ways that you can make visual contact with a migrating bird at night is to put a telescope right on the moon and literally count the number of silhouettes that pass that one space. And through all kinds of different extrapolations, estimate how many birds are actually passing over your location based on just that. And so literally people out in the field looking at the moon through a telescope all night long, making a note of all the birds that are passing.
Wow.
Which, if you think about the size of the moon in the sky, for the naked eye, that's a small patch of sky, right? And the fact that there's a sizable number of birds passing by that one little dot in the sky is pretty amazing. So that's one thing that people started to do, and some real data came from it. Another way of trying to track songbirds migrating at night was by recording their nocturnal flight calls. So with a large flock of songbirds, a lot of times they are making little chirp, kind of identification calls to each other constantly as they're flying to sort of know where each other are in the dark. And it's evidently quite a common thing for songbirds to do this. And so people would set up these microphones, these very sensitive microphones facing the sky all night long and record it all night long.
Wow.
And then analyze the data in a sonogram, so get a visual image of the sound waves and be able to identify, people who are good at this could identify what species it is and how many birds are passing over that particular location. And then there's a bunch of math you have to do to try to estimate, like, how many birds are actually going by this broader area. Anyway, another innovation, starting in the 1960s, researchers began to experiment with radio telemetry. A lot of this technology, I really don't understand what it is, but maybe someone out there does. So I'm not going to explain to you how radio telemetry works. It's not my job this evening. Some people who really were interested in bird migration began to design radio transmitters that could be attached to birds without disrupting the normal movement and behavior of the bird. So this turned out to be a huge challenge because, as we learned my last bird lecture, flight depends on being really, really strong and being really, really light. The birds have to be super strong and super light to stay in the air. And so whatever these transmitters have to be, they can't be heavy because they'll mess up the bird's flight, particularly a bird that you're trying to trace through a very stressful migration. You don't want to add any unnecessary weight to this bird's body. So they have to be really, really light. They have to be attached to the bird with some sort of harness, some sort of like backpack, basically, that wouldn't obstruct the bird's flight. Later on, when these transmitters are really, really, really tiny, ornithologists would go to the pharmacy and buy eyelash glue, and they could actually because eyelash glue is sensitive to your skin, it doesn't burn your skin and everything, whatever. So they would glue it to the backs of birds, and that would actually last a while. These little transmitters had to carry batteries that wouldn't immediately die. So it doesn't do you any good to attach a transmitter to a bird if the battery dies a week later. You haven't really found anything out about where that bird is going. Later on, a lot of these transmitters were developed that were solar powered. So it's something that's resting on the back of a bird and it's charging all the time during the daylight hours. There's a story by a guy named Bill Cochran, who, if you read this book, he is a legendary ornithologist, a really sounds like a really eccentric guy, but he did a lot of work in bird migration and technical innovations to allow him and his colleagues to find things out. He really wanted to track a bird in real time, and so he tagged a bird with a transmitter in Illinois. It was a Swainson's thrush, similar to the wood thrush that we saw a minute ago. This is in 1973. And because the transmitter that he had invented and put on this bird only had a range of a few miles, Cochran and his assistant followed the bird in their station wagon with a giant receiver antenna sticking through the roof of the car. And the receiver would emit a little beeping noise as long as the bird was in range, as long as the transmitter was in range. So they literally were following the beeps of this bird. They followed it because it was a nocturnal migrator, so it would sort of rest during the day and fly at night. They followed it over the course of a week, 7 nights in a row, 930 miles. It crossed the Canadian border into Manitoba. They got hung up at the border crossing, and they lost it. And then they got over the border and were able to find it again. Eventually, they lost it for good. But meanwhile, they're collecting all kinds of data about how this bird migrates, the elevation, what altitude it's flying at, all kinds of things like this. Anyway, this is what the curiosity drives people to do. So radio technology... there's a whole bunch of other amazing kinds of radio technology, little transmitters, and a whole network of radio towers that pick it up. I'm not going to talk about that, but that's another source of a lot of information. One of the shortcomings of radio technology is that you're not able to track birds that fly these epic long journeys over the ocean. Nothing is within range. And so since the mid-1980s, some of these ornithologists began to discuss and figure out ways that they could invent and attach satellite transmitters to migratory birds that would be light enough but strong enough to send a signal into space. And then it's a complicated story, but basically the first actual satellite that was used to track birds is called the Argo. And later on, there's other satellites that are used for that purpose. Some of those the very first transmitters that were satellite transmitters were so big, they're about the size and weight of a hockey puck.
Oh, nice.
And the only birds that they could put them on were swans and golden eagles, because those were the only birds that were huge enough to still fly with one of these on their back. Gradually, they were able, again, the technology got better and better. They got lighter and lighter to the point where since at least 2000, maybe the years after 2000, sometimes they are actually surgically implanted into a bird in a way that does not disrupt the bird's aerodynamics at all. So that sounds crazy to me, but people do it. And so satellite transmitters, that allows researchers to actually observe the progress of a bird's migration almost in real time. It's not constantly pinging, but it gives you a very, very, like, moment-by-moment idea of where a particular bird is going over thousands of miles from your computer screen. So this is some of the research that my brother Tim has done with Wimbrel and with oyster catchers. This is a Wimbrel. This is one of the satellite, the solar-powered satellite transmitters on its back. This is a Wimbrel resting in the sand with an antenna sticking out. Basically, it doesn't impede the bird at all. It's extremely light, but it actually increases the chances of you getting a good signal. These are three unimpeded Wimbrel just flying without any transmitters. But that's a Wimbrel. Actually, one of the birds on the piano is a Wimbrel. Okay. Key features of migration. We still haven't really talked much about what it actually is. just gonna drink something. Is everybody okay? People need to stretch. Birds migrate because their life cycle has adapted to the seasonal changes of planet Earth. So because of seasonal changes, abundant food and then safe places to raise their young do not consistently overlap. These things are changing because of seasons. Birds breed, nest, and raise their young in one area. Often, most of the birds we're talking about they breed and nest and have their young in the far north. This is their breeding ground for many reasons. After the ice thaws in the spring, if we're talking about shorebirds particularly, after the ice thaws in the spring, there's an abundant source of food along the water, on mudflats and things like that, in the grasslands, high tundra kind of grasslands. And they need an abundant source of food if they're going to raise healthy brood of chicks. Right? There needs to be a lot of food where they're raising their young. And in the far north, there's just a lot of habitat for safe nesting sites. And so a lot of these migratory shorebirds, the sandpipers and the Wimbrel, these kinds of birds, migrate very, very far north into the Canadian tundra and Siberian tundra, these kinds of places. And that's where they raise their young. But when the breeding season is over and the young are strong enough to fly, this coincides with the weather getting very cold indeed and their food supply dwindling. So birds migrate further south, sometimes way further south, where there's abundant food and much milder winter temperatures. And so this is the bird's wintering ground. So you basically have these two main locations, breeding ground, wintering ground, usually corresponding to the north and the south. All of this varies a lot depending on the species of bird. So the basic categories are pretty consistent, though. Breeding ground, lots of food, nesting habitat, wintering ground, lots of food and milder temperatures. The general migration route that a bird will take between their breeding ground and their wintering ground is called a flyway. It's basically the migration route. Bird migration is it's not a free-for-all where every individual bird does whatever it feels like. Birds usually migrate in fairly large flocks, roughly along these established routes. There's basically four, loosely four identified flyways in this country. This is an image of them. Atlantic flyway, Mississippi flyway, birds that are traveling along basically the lowland waterways all the way down. Central sort of grassland approaching Rockies flyway, and then the Pacific flyway. You can break these into smaller categories if you want, but still these most ornithologists talk about these as the main four flyways of migratory birds through North America. The breeding grounds and wintering grounds for birds are often massive and spread out. So birds, a species of bird will spread way out on their breeding ground, way out in their wintering ground. But in contrast, the flyway is much more focused. Sometimes because of geography, topography, hills and mountains, the flyway can become fairly narrow in places. One example of this is in Cape May, New Jersey. Exotic Cape May, New Jersey. Anyone ever been to Cape May? Yeah. This is Cape May way at the bottom of the map here. It's one of the best places to birdwatch in the fall in the world, actually. During the fall migration, you can see thousands and thousands of hawks every day, every species in North America in a day. Same goes for shorebirds, warblers, everything. One of the reasons is the particular shape of the coastline and the surrounding hills. You have birds that are flying down along this waterway. You have birds flying along the coast, and they get basically funneled into this tiny little spit of land that they're following before they make the jump over Delaware Bay and further south. So because of the geography of Cape May, it acts like a funnel. So every migratory bird tends to go through here. It's an excellent place to do bird research because you're having a whole population of a bird species coming through one area. Not the whole population, but a large percentage. And this brings us to another important feature of migration. So we've talked about breeding grounds, wintering grounds. Very often a whole population of migrating bird will rely on a very specific location along their route to rest and to feed and to basically refuel before continuing on the rest of their migration. These are called stopover sites. A stopover. And they're completely essential for many bird species to survive migration. If they don't have a good stopover, they just don't make it. So stopovers are often not big places at all, but they have to be places with abundant food and relative shelter so the bird can get its energy back and basically replenish its fat supply for the rest of the journey. This is especially true for shorebirds, migratory shorebirds, sandpipers and plovers and things like that that migrate really far distances. They really, really, really need these stopover places, usually along the coast. But because they're relatively small, these sites, relative to the breeding ground and the wintering ground, a huge number of birds from a species will funnel through this one area and then depend on this one area and then fan out again. If you look at the migration map, it looks kind of like an hourglass. You have the birds spread out for the breeding ground and then coming through this one area that they all depend on and then fanning out again on the other side of the globe. This means that a very large percentage of the global population of a species might rely on the health of that particular very small ecosystem at a particular time every year. And this is where you can see where we're going with this. This is the vulnerability aspect of migration. If an entire population of a species depends on the health and vitality of this one little spot, and that gets messed up, then it's in trouble. So those are just the basic features of a migration route. Let's talk about some of the star migrators in the world. There's some big stars. One of the best-known migrators in the world is the Arctic tern. This is a seabird that dives for fish on the surface. There's lots of different kinds of terns. Some of them are very small. Some of them are huge. This is a sort of a medium-sized tern. And they, very often off the coast of Massachusetts, you can see terns kind of hovering in big flocks over the water and then diving into the water for small fish. That's how they survive. But the Arctic tern has the record for the most miles traveled every year, basically. Arctic terns migrate from the high Arctic all the way south to Antarctica and then back every year. Their migration, while it's very long, it's not done all at once because they're sea feeding birds. They're kind of feeding as they go, and they sort of make their way over the course of some time. So it's not as if it's one flight, but they still cover a whole lot of miles every year. Some tiny little songbirds are also very impressive migrators. This is a black poem warbler. Not uncommon to see, well, pretty uncommon to see around here. They, as you can see on the map, their wintering ground is boreal forests of northern Canada. I mean, their breeding ground is northern Canada. They migrate between Canada and South America every year. The southern leg of that journey in the fall is made over open ocean. Warblers are land birds. They're perching birds, meaning they need a stick or something solid to perch on. They don't just land on anything. So stopping to take a rest on the water is not an option for any warbler, any perching bird. This means that they make that flight nonstop from New England to Venezuela, which is, you know, roughly 1,800 miles. This is a bird that weighs about 10 grams. That's less than half an ounce. That's 2 nickels. Or a ballpoint pen, roughly, is the weight of a black pole warbler. And this is, all kinds of warblers travel very far distances. This is the most impressive of the small little songbirds. That is astounding. If that doesn't fill us with something like awe, then there's something wrong with us, I think. It's like, this is really amazing. That weighs that could pack enough energy to survive flying straight for 1,800 miles.
How long does that take,
though? Good question. I don't have that information right on me, but it would probably take a couple of days of straight flying. Yeah.
So no food, no stops.
Nothing. Yeah.
Wow.
They eat insects. They eat insects and like caterpillars and things like that. So there's nothing. They're not eating anything or stopping. Yeah.
Would they land on a ship, do you think, if there was one?
They might possibly, but they can't depend on that. Yeah, I mean, I've heard of stories of that, like songbirds landing on random boats just to like, you know. But I don't know how common that is. Yeah. So we're still working our way through some of the stars here. For some birds, particularly the shorebirds, so the sandpipers, the birds you see running along in the mudflats and feeding. It gets even more staggering to me in terms of the extended endurance that's required. This is a bar-tailed godwit. So they look very different. This is in breeding plumage, so the beautiful red sort of rust color. This is in winter plumage, so they totally change color in the wintertime. They molt their summer feathers and put out new feathers. So it's the same species of bird. They look totally different depending on what time of year you see them. For years, researchers have known that the bar-tailed godwit breeds in the Alaskan and Siberian tundra. So way, way, way up here. And winters in New Zealand and Australia. This is, of course, impressive because obviously they get from one place to the other. That's a long ways. Only in 2007, after tracking an individual bird with a satellite transmitter, there was a famous bar-tailed godwit called E7. They named it E7. In 2007, they finally proved that the bar-tailed godwit makes their southern migration in one flight. So that is from the Alaskan tundra to New Zealand. E7, this particular bird, did it in, I think, 7 days, 7,000 miles.
Wow.
without stopping. Again, this is not a land bird. It's a shore bird, so it's used to running along in the mud flats and stuff like that. But it still can't land on the water. It's not a seagull or a duck. It's not going to land on the water. It has to just... It's flying. 7,000 miles in one flight. How in the world? How in the world does a creature do this? This is a flight map of E7, particularly. You can go online and Google Bartail Goblet E7. It's like, oh, E7, E7. With paparazzi, people following E7 in their groups. But yeah, this is the flight. It's a female. Female Bartail Goblet flew from here to here in one go. Yeah.
Did migration patterns follow wind?
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit. A lot of times, the birds are taking advantage of wind currents. For instance, these birds, they time their migration to coincide with a very, very strong tailwind, a southerly wind out of Alaska. So they kind of get launched going like 60 miles an hour out of Alaska, and they ride it as long as they can. Yeah.
Wow.
So if they were going against a headwind, they wouldn't make it.
Right.
Yeah, so it's definitely, that's part of the complexity of this, is the following the, yeah, that's true. I don't know. So what in the world? What's happening here? Some of what I'm going to share is specifically about bar-tailed godwits, just because it's such an extreme example. It's just kind of interesting to talk about them, but various different birds that migrate long distances will do these things in various different ways. So this is not, I'm not telling you about how all birds survive this, but there's three different kinds of questions that bird biologists ask. How do they make their way? In other words, how does the physical endurance of this actually work? How do they physically do it? How do they find their way? That's a question about navigation, because you can't afford to get lost if you're... and how do they learn to find their way? That's about the origin of navigational skill. How does a bird know this? How do they come to know it? All three of these are really big questions that differ from species to species. But I'll just sort of like tip my hat at each one of these as we pass by each question. So migration, first of all, how does a bird do it? The physical ordeal, looking at the bar-tailed godwit, to make a journey that long and survive it, the godwit's body has to function with absolute efficiency, which means it has to undergo very dramatic changes before migrating. So for a bird, efficiency means be as strong as possible while weighing as little as possible while carrying as much fuel as possible. Right. So all three of those things, it has to do all those things. As the days start to shorten in the north, so as the days start to shorten and get colder, the seasons are turning towards autumn. The change in daylight hours seems to stimulate a neurological change in the bird's brain. So they know that, okay, this is time. It's getting ready for migration. And long distance migrators, it sort of causes them, it stimulates their bodies to go into this phase called hyperphagia. It's your nice $10 word for tonight. It's basically a state in which the bird eats excessively and puts on weight really, really, really fast. So it's gorging on as much food as it can within a short time. Godwits will double their body weight in 2 or 3 weeks. I thought of trying to do that once. Not as healthy for people to try that. the energy is stored as fat, which is relatively light but densely packed source of energy for a bird to carry. Unlike people, like if I'm running along, like going on a long run, which I never do, but if I was, I am unable to burn my fat directly and turn it into energy. Right. This is why I carbo, you know, people talk about carbo loading the day before a big race or something, because we burn on carbohydrate. You know, the energy we can access quickly is not our fat deposits. Unlike that, a bird's metabolism is very, very different. A bird can burn its fat and turn it into energy in real time, immediately. which means that building up its fat deposits are a very efficient way to carry energy. So the condition of a bird's fat deposits on either side of its abdomen, one of the ways that ornithologists check to see whether a bird is healthy and strong enough to migrate. It's one of the things you always do when you band a bird. You turn it on its back, you blow on its breast feathers, and then you can actually see the skin of the bird. You actually see these big deposits of fat. If the bird is healthy and strong and ready to go, it's very, very visible. It's easy to tell. Are this bird's tanks full or are they not? If a bird runs out of energy mid-flight over the ocean, it will literally just drop out of the sky. It runs out of energy and it dies. There's nothing to do about it. Also, leading up to migration, godwits and other shorebirds increase the size of their hearts and lung, their hearts and flight muscles. So the breast muscles, the power muscles for flying, because they're flapping birds, they're not like soaring or anything like that. The size of their flight muscles and their heart actually increase significantly. These are the essential muscles that they need for flying. All birds have a super, super efficient respiratory system, but the speed of oxygen absorption is really, really important during long migrations. It's more important than ever. Even the most ordinary bird, has lungs that allow constant flow of oxygen to pass through them. Rather than, mammal lungs, you're inhaling fresh air, you're using the oxygen, you're exhaling, back and forth and back and forth. A bird actually can absorb fresh air in a one-way direction through its lungs constantly. It does this by a whole system of air sacs that are in its body as well as its bones. People talk about birds having hollow bones. It's true. One of the reasons they have hollow bones is that the bones store and circulate oxygen. The bones are actually part of their respiratory system in a way that mammals don't do. Also, for the sake of efficiency, a bird's body goes through a process. This is specifically these godwits, these super, super long, long migrating birds. This is another fun word, autophagy. This comes from the Greek, which literally means self-eating. autophagy is basically a process that different animals do this on a cellular level. It's like how we get rid of waste in our cells. A doctor could tell you more about it. But basically, in the case of migratory birds, basically the unnecessary organs in their body atrophy to almost disappearing. sexual organs, liver, kidneys, part of its digestive tract basically atrophy and are absorbed into the body so they weigh nothing. and this makes more room for the bird to carry the fat deposits it needs. Basically, it's trimming down to like the essential, absolutely essential things it needs. After landing in its final destination, these birds have to immediately begin eating, right? And then they begin to recover their normal metabolism. There's been some studies that indicate also that godwits, because birds need to sleep just like people do, two halves of the brain, one of them sleeps, the other one stays awake. And then they alternate. And then they alternate. And then they alternate back and forth for the entire flight. I don't know. Yeah. It's a thing. Okay. Lastly, the thing Peter mentioned, taking advantage of weather patterns and wind is really, really important. A tailwind is a huge help to birds that are actually going to survive a long journey. How do they find their way? That's the second question we were talking about. How do they make their way is a matter of physical endurance. How do they find their way? That's a question of navigation. Bird navigation alone is just a huge topic that is really complicated. I'm just, again, like as with everything, I'm just kind of tipping my hat to it as we pass by. People have been aware of the homing ability of birds for ages. Like Roman generals would keep swallows with them and tie little strings to their legs and send them up in the air and they'd fly back to Rome. And things like this, people have been aware of this. Pigeons are famously good at homing. People occasionally do competitions where they to see how far away they can take their pigeons and still have them fly back to their roost. This is a thing people do, I guess. starting in World War II. Oh, there's a picture of it. This is one of our migratory birds. Here's the ruby-throated hummingbird, our smallest North American bird. Okay, so starting in World War II, some ornithologists started to experiment with this bird, the Manx shearwater, by testing its homing capability. They wanted to know, how good is this bird at homing, basically at finding its way back? Shearwaters are true pelagic birds. That means they're open ocean birds. They live the vast majority of their life not in sight of land. They can live on the water. They feed on the water. They can rest on the water. Everything. They come to land only to breed and have their young, usually in these isolated islands off in the North Atlantic. So one island is off the coast of Wales, and these are sort of nesting colonies that have lots of little holes in the cliffs, and the shearwaters have their young there, and that's really the only time they come to land. Scientists conducted essentially blindfolded experiments with these birds, with the Manx shearwater. They were taken from their nesting site in Wales, and then driven all over, put in a box, driven all over Great Britain, just to see how well can these birds find their way home. Every single one of the Great Britain birds found their way home very quickly to the same hole they came from. They're that focused, that precise. So they decided to push it more. Like, okay, that's great. How good are these birds? They put a bird on a plane and sent it to Venice, where no shearwaters ever go. No shearwater has ever naturally wound up in Venice. Rather than heading south to the ocean, heading for the water, where you'd think a pelagic bird would go instinctively, that's where I want to go. The Venetian bird flew northwest over the Italian Alps, over Western Europe, and landed in its hole in Wales.
Wow.
341 hours later. Years later, this was after the war, one of these ornithologists, his name was Matthews, I forget his name, he took a Manx shearwater from the same Welsh island, put it in a box, flew it to Boston. It was released just outside of Boston Harbor, and was found back in its nesting hole 12 days later. 12 days, 12 hours later. So the guy, Matthews, the guy who was back in Wales checking for it, he had to check its band over and over and over again because he didn't believe it was the same bird, but it was.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was shocked. He sent a telegram back to his colleague.
Oh!
Yeah. Yeah. So,
12 hours?
12 days and 12 hours later.
12 days then.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Granted, this is a bird that could feed on the water. This is not, this is a bird that, but still, 12 days, that's a pretty good pace to make it from Boston back to Wales. So these experiments raise a lot of questions. I mean, they're just like super exciting and amazing, but they also raise a lot of questions. What is going on here? How do birds navigate to distant, precise location and then back? Migratory birds will do this every year. This is a normal thing. A lot of times birds will hatch in a place, they'll migrate across the world, and they'll come back to the same bush a year later. So like, what is, this is the level of precision is crazy. This is a really interesting book called The Homing Instinct. It's by Bernd Heinrich. He's a really interesting writer. He's done a lot of work on all kinds of different animals, but this is about the instinct to home. Basically, he talks about bees, he talks about all kinds of different creatures, but there's a great section on migratory birds in here. How does a bird reorient itself after being disoriented and still wind up where it wants to go, flying over totally unfamiliar territory? What are its tools of navigation? So there's no simple answer to this question. There's a lot of partial answers. To navigate successfully in the real world actually requires the formation of a mental map of some kind in the brain, right? We have no idea what the consciousness of a bird is like, but in to some degree there has to be a mental map formed in the brain, as well as an ability to orient yourself in relation to that mental map. It's all well and good to have a mental map, but you have to then say, where am I on that map? So there's been multiple experiments with different species of birds to try to get at this question. And it seems that, I'm just going to mention some of the ways that birds seem to be able to navigate. Not every species of bird does all of these things, but a lot of birds do navigate using visual landmarks. So migrating along a coastline, mountains, particular shapes of the landscape, forests, birds seem to be able to remember and identify where they're going based on those things, reference points. That doesn't work if you're flying over open ocean. The night sky, actually, there's been some experiments that show that birds actually are able to navigate in relationship to the stars.
Wow.
Again, we don't know how conscious a thing this is. It's not the same sort of thing necessarily that a sailor would do with their sextant. But many birds seem to have brains that can detect the magnetic field produced by the poles of the earth, very much the same as a compass does. And so orienting themselves north and south is a thing that most birds can just do. the next question, if you remember our third question there, is how does a bird learn, where does the navigational tool come from? Where does that capacity come from? And do birds hatch out of the egg with the ability hardwired into them, or do they learn migration routes by flying first with their parents or in a larger flock of more experienced birds, or is it some combination of the two? This is sort of a nature-nurture question. If you think about it, what's innate or what is it environmental? What is taught and learned? There's a Dutch ornithologist named Albert Perdek, who conducted a bunch of experiments on the European starling. This is a starling. In America, they're kind of a hassle because they're an introduced species and they're obnoxious to other birds, and they reproduce and drive other birds out of their nesting holes. So in America, this bird is kind of a menace. But it's a European starling. When it's in Europe, it's great. So anyway, this guy did a bunch of experiments with European starlings. displacement studies, basically. So you capture a bunch of birds and take them really far off their course. Birds that were heading south, so birds that were starting their autumn migration. And he did a bunch of different studies between from the late 50s all the way up into the 80s. And so he has a lot of data. In his experiments, both adult birds and first year juvenile birds were captured and moved way, 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 way off their migration route, disorienting them basically as much as possible. You know. His experiments repeatedly showed, over and over again, that juvenile birds, I'll explain this image in a second, juvenile birds were able to direct themselves south from their new location. So if you think about it, you're on a course, this is where I am, I'm heading over here, I get taken way off course, way over here, I still can find south. So the juvenile birds would start flying on a course parallel to the one they would have been on. Does that make sense? They could still navigate in a southerly direction. This is called one direction orientation or vector navigation. If you can just tell you could go south. The older birds, though, who had migrated before, were able to correct their flight path and arrive at their original wintering ground. This is called true goal orientation, which is significantly more impressive. So this is the juvenile. This little image is quite helpful, actually. This is their breeding ground. They're heading this way. This is their destination they want to go to. They get caught and flown on a plane way over here. The juveniles are able to still fly in a southerly direction, but they don't wind up where they were intending to wind up. Whereas the adult birds, same thing, they're flying towards their destination, they get rerouted, and then they redirect towards their... So that's called true goal orientation. They're able to just find where they were going. So this reveals something really interesting about migratory birds, the nature-nurture question, at least for starlings. This doesn't necessarily apply to every bird. A young starling who's never migrated before has some sort of innate hardwired compass, internal compass. They don't have to learn how to discern north from south. But they don't automatically have the ability to reorient themselves relative to a specific goal. Whereas the older birds were able to do this, which indicates that true goal orientation is a learned behavior, which means, at least in starlings, in their first or maybe second migration, they're learning something as they fly with older birds about some sort of mental map is being formed. So that's just one example of a navigation experiment that's trying to get at that question, where does it come from? Very similar experiments were done with the white-crowned sparrow, which is an American species, a West Coast species, used to be very common in the wintertime in California. Similar things were shown with them. Okay, so I'm going to just... we're getting to this question of migration as a window into a crisis. So many of the recent innovations in migration science have revealed, hopefully not too late, that birds are in serious trouble. And, you know, there was not necessarily any way of knowing until some of these technologies were invented and you start to actually look at numbers of migratory birds. Migration puts a whole population of bird in a very, very vulnerable position, right? Lots of things have to happen just right for a bird to survive the journey, all the things we've been talking about, the physical stress. It's such a serious stress on a bird's body that there's not a lot of room for error, actually. The fact is that even under very normal and natural circumstances, going back thousands of years, some birds would not survive the journey. That's totally normal, obviously. Bad weather particularly is devastating to small birds that are migrating. A flash storm out of nowhere will just like devastate a huge number of birds. And that's been going on forever. That being said, bird populations are plummeting in a way that cannot be explained by normal stresses of migration. And ornithologists all over the world acknowledge this. This is not like a fringe perspective. Birds are very powerful, tough, resilient, but they have a limit. And when we witness migration, we're observing a behavior that is the result of many thousands of years of adapting to a relatively consistent world. It's like thousands of years of adapting to relatively consistent conditions. If you think about the relative consistency of food sources, relative consistency of habitat along their flyway, relative consistency of temperatures, of seasonal change, relative consistency of sea levels, of weather patterns. None of these things can be relied upon anymore. And birds are really not able to adapt quickly enough to the kind of sudden changes that are happening environmentally now. So a 2019 study, this is published in the journal Science, estimated the population of North American birds. This is talking about all birds in North America. This isn't just focusing on any one species. Of the population of all North American birds has dropped 30% since 1970. This is nearly 3 billion fewer birds than there were 50 years ago. It's really hard to contemplate exactly what that means. But there's 3 billion fewer birds than there were 50 years ago in North America. In other words, birds are dying at a much faster rate than they're reproducing. And again, this statistic includes all birds, species belonging to every family of bird. In fact, some of the species that are in steepest decline are considered very common birds. Some of the birds that we are used to seeing all the time, those are species that are actually taking very, very significant nosedive. Orioles, red-winged blackbirds, finches, swallows, these are birds that are just sort of normal to see. So there's sort of the entire class, avis, of birds is decreasing in population on average as a class. But there are also particular species within that class that are facing much more imminent extinction. So that's a different issue. They're included in that number, but not every bird is in that dire a state. One, a particular, just for a case study, is a red knot. That's a migratory shorebird, a small sandpiper, beautiful bird in its breeding plumage. migrates very far. You can see it's northern Hudson Bay all the way down to Patagonia. Their population has declined 87% since 2000. So they're listed as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And there's a variety of reasons for this. One of the complications about migratory shorebirds is that the laws about hunting birds differ from country to country. And so you can have birds that are protected in North America that fly across the Gulf of Mexico to Venezuela and then get shot immediately because it's not illegal to hunt them in other countries. So that's just one complication to the whole thing. And when people talk about bird conservation, it's an international quandary because it doesn't matter how well you protect a bird when it's flying over your country, if it's going to fly over through unprotected land. Anyway, the red knot is particularly dependent on Delaware Bay, which is right here as its stopover place, between its wintering grounds and its breeding grounds. Horseshoe crab eggs in and around Delaware Bay are the main food source for red knots as they migrate along the East Coast. Horseshoe crabs are in decline because actually the U.S. biomedical industry harvests horseshoe crabs because the horseshoe crab blood is super, super valuable for different biomedical purposes. So horseshoe crabs are being over-harvested by the biomedical industry, which means that the knots arrive halfway along their enormous migratory route to Delaware Bay, and there's no food, or very little. And they can't refuel. They don't have the energy to either continue. They either starve there, or they barely make it to where they're going, not really strong enough to recover. This is very closely linked to its rapid decline. There's lots of other things, including hunting, including other factors, but this seems to be the main one. So the plight of the red knot showcases the ecological importance of stopover sites. If a stopover is degraded or depleted, an entire species can go into a nosedive, right? Because remember, we talked about species spread all over the hemisphere, funnels through one little area and depends on that area. If that area is threatened, then you're talking about an entire species under threat. Loss of coastal habitat because of development is a huge factor. Actually, for a lot of these shorebirds and as well as marsh birds, rising sea levels are hugely destructive. We're not talking about cliffs along a coastline. If you think about the average sea level rising a few inches, doesn't make any difference if you have a steep coastline, right? You don't think about it. But we're talking about habitat, which is very, very, very slight incline. We're talking about mudflats and marshes and places that are very, very vulnerable as wetlands. A few inches of sea rise is an enormous amount of horizontal space flooded, if you think about. This is the habitat that they depend on for food. They're mudflat feeders. They're feeding on worms and different invertebrates that grow in the mud. So in the case of birds that nest in marshland, if you calculate in rising sea level and then extreme weather events, a lot of times nesting habitat is just like decimated because they've adapted to live very close to sea level. This is where they live. Okay, what about songbirds? I'll just show you this. So the red knot is particularly under threat in America and South America, in the east, eastern hemisphere, in China. Spoon-billed sandpiper is going through a similar thing. Almost, I think they're in worse shape than the red knot. They depend on the Yellow Sea as their stopover place from Siberia going all the way down to Indonesia and Malaysia, and I think further south too. But the Yellow Sea here is enormous amount of mud flat that is getting land reclamation by China. It's actually never was land, so it's not reclaiming the land, but it is basically dumping tons of fill and developing out into the Yellow Sea, which is some of these very, very specific bits of habitat are necessary for this bird and many others. So So there's a lot of cooperation between scientists all over the world, including a lot of Chinese biologists trying to save this bird, which looks like it might not be around in a few years. Songbirds, a little bit of a different situation. Rising temperatures and erratic weather are also threatening the population of many of these small songbirds, warblers particularly, and thrushes like the wood thrush that we were talking about earlier. Imagine this. So if a flock of little songbirds, they finish a leg of a long journey, and they arrive at a stopover where they've always relied on an abundant crop of caterpillars for food. But because the spring temperatures get warmer earlier in that location, all the caterpillars are already gone. Huge numbers of that bird will starve very quickly because they're tiny birds. Or arrive at their final location too weak to breed and have young that are healthy. So this is a question of timing. Different changes in temperature affecting the timing of migration, where a bird arrives in a place, but the food that's supposed to be there is not there because the temperature is so different than it should be. So you can see how complex the problems are. The reason the problems are so complex is that birds, like all living creatures, can only really exist within systems of interdependence. This is what we're talking about. Like, every living creature on the earth lives in a system of interdependence. And this is, I'm moving towards my conclusion here. Have faith. We're almost there. At the beginning of the lecture, I talked about what might we learn about God as we look at creation. If we hold the Bible in one hand, but look more closely at creation, what are some of God's creative tendencies? And the way I want to approach this is looking at these two things very, very briefly: interdependence and fecundity. That's my other $10 word for tonight. God seems to love complex systems of interdependence. This is what an ecosystem is. What ecosystem means is a complex system of interdependence. Different creatures depending on each other in a variety of different ways, in which the health of the whole depends on the health of each part. God did not create a world in which every creature lines up at the end of the day to receive their food directly from his hand. It's not like punching out at the end of the day or getting your paycheck at the end of the day. That's not how God designs things. As if every creature is independent of every other creature. That's not true. Rather, God provides for his creatures through their relationship with the rest of creation. Every creature is embedded in and dependent on the rest of creation. If you just go and read Psalm 104 with this idea in mind, it's a beautiful picture of this dynamic of interdependence of different species on each other within the broader understanding of God's provision. It's still God providing for his creatures, but he's providing for his creatures through a very complex system that he's designed, in which they depend on each other. Human beings are no different, actually. We don't like to think of ourselves as being embedded and dependent on creation, but we are. Some of us just have means of avoiding that reality more than others. But human beings are every bit as dependent on creation as any other creature. And we've been talking about birds tonight, but this is the case for anything that's alive. Another one of God's creative tendencies is his delight in the fecundity of creation. So fecundity, old-fashioned word, weird-sounding word. Basically, it means the capacity for fruitfulness and abundance. The capacity for overflowing abundance. You see this in Genesis 1. You see this in many places. You see it in creation. When God invents a creature, he wants there to be a lot of them. His intention for this planet is for there to be an explosion of diverse life. Teeming. He wants his planet to be teeming with life. Both lots of variety, diversity. You know, God loves the variety of his creation, but he also wants lots of each variety. He wants there to be abundant population of species. When he says, go, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, he says this to every single species. He doesn't just say this to people. He doesn't just say this to just general categories. This is something that's spoken and is obviously a communication of his desire. So when it comes to the fecundity of birds, the capacity for abundance, a historical perspective is really quite important. We tend to get used to whatever we see on a daily basis. So I don't usually think, wow, there are very few birds in my neighborhood. I don't usually think that. Whatever I happen to see, I'm likely to think of that as normal. But our standards for what seems normal change unconsciously over time. This means that I have very little idea of what has been lost in the past 50 years, in the past 20 years, in the past 10 years. None of us have a very good concept of what has actually been lost when you go back that many years. Early accounts of migrations in this country, especially of waterfowl in the central flyway, are astounding. People talk about the sky being darkened for days on end because of all the geese and ducks and other birds migrating en masse. And that just is not the case anymore. We have undergone and are still undergoing a tremendous loss of abundance. It's not just about grieving extinctions. It's about grieving the loss of abundance. There's supposed to be a lot, and there's not. But it's a loss of abundance that very few people experience as a loss on a gut level. Like I said, we don't even notice. Yeah, there's birds. Yeah, there's sure. I hear them. They wake me up in the morning. God wants to fill the earth with birds. We are on our way to emptying the earth of birds. That's a very strong statement, and I hope that that's not fully the case, but we're on a trajectory that I think grieves God and should grieve us if we want to love the things that he loves. Whether we like it or not, these two concepts are bound together, fecundity and interdependence. The way God designed creation, it's only through interdependence that there could be abundance. It's only by understanding that interdependence and trying to care for all aspects of the natural world that we can protect each part of it. And this is what ecology is all about. This is why it's so complicated. This is why it's so hard. This is why so many people don't want to think about it, because it involves too many considerations. But it's because of interdependence. But that's interdependence, whether we like it or not, is the only way that abundance occurs in God's design. So, what is the hope? I'm not going to go into great detail here. I'm going to give you a picture of our wood thrush one more time. There is actually a huge, significant difference. I'm just going to talk about two very briefly, between Christian creation care and secular environmentalism. There's a lot that the Christians who care about creation, there's a lot that we can share with secular environmentalists in terms of our concerns and the things we're doing. But there's a huge difference, really, in where a Christian creation care person is standing. And I'll just mention, too, very, very briefly, a Christian person who's concerned for creation care has a relational motivation for caring and taking action. A relational motivation in that I know the God who made this and the God who wants to preserve it. And that God is my Lord, who I serve, and it's a matter of obedience, but also of love for God, that I would care at all and try to do anything at all about this. There's all kinds of ways in which different secular environmentalists seek spiritual motivations or grounding for what they're doing, and I sympathize. You know, if you don't believe in God, coming up with some sort of spiritual understanding of what it is you're doing, but it's not relational. It's not a relationship to a maker God who is personal. The second thing is a solid hope that our work is not in vain. Some of the most terribly despairing people are environmentalists today. Because if you look around at the state of the world and you think, wow, it's really up to us to do something about this, and if we don't, it's done. Despair is kind of, seems like the only option. But a Christian person who cares about creation actually believes that our work is not in vain, actually believes our eschatology is super, super important in terms of the hope we can maintain while we care about the world, because we believe in a God who actually is going to make all things new, is going to renew his creation. This is the reason why I called my series Birds of the Kingdom, because I wanted to communicate that God's renewal of all things, whenever that takes place, includes renewal of his creation, includes the birds. I'm not making some heretical statement about that birds have souls or something like that. I'm just saying birds are part of the creation that God will renew. That's where I'm going to end. Yeah. So at LaBrie, I know I've gone a long time. Thank you for your patience. If you have any questions or comments or anything, please feel free. We'll have some time for discussion. If you need to leave now, that's just fine. Don't feel bad. But if you'd like to stay, please do. Yeah, Peter.
I may be asking a question that's better for your brother, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Every question would be better for my brother on this topic.
Do you know if over open water, if migrating birds change altitude? I ask because the Polynesian wave readers, I mean, they will look at the direction of waves and even maybe listen to currents. Mm-hmm. If birds possibly visualize where currents are going and somehow use those as a frame of reference?
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's... There's certainly... In terms of air currents and altitude, I don't know for sure. I'm sure someone does. There is one of the projects years ago that my brother did was satellite transmitters on Wimbrel, like the shorebird with the downturned bill. And they were able to capture a handful of birds, outfit them with these satellite transmitters, and then follow their course along the coast, heading towards Suriname, sort of like the north coast of South America. It happened to be at a time when there was a gigantic hurricane working its way up the coast. And so you're like, what's going to happen to these birds? They only had maybe one or two birds tagged, but they assume that a bird like that's flying in a flock of hundreds. You know, it could be a huge flock of birds. You're just following one of them. So this particular bird flew south directly at this hurricane, about 100 miles north of it. It did basically a right angle turn, flew out over the open ocean, completely avoiding the hurricane, and landed in Suriname. So there's some capacity to discern barometric pressure or something, I don't know. Yeah. And avoid weather like that. That doesn't mean that birds always avoid extreme weather. Sometimes they get nailed, but in this particular case, this flock of birds somehow knew to get out of the way of the hurricane 100 miles before they actually started experiencing the wind.
Isn't that the way the wind would be? Don't they spin like this? Wouldn't that be the wind direction?
It might have been, yeah. They might have just let the wind take them in that direction, and then they reoriented themselves to their... That could have been the case, yeah. I don't know. But in any case, I'm sure the birds are doing that. But I don't, yeah.
But I mean, isn't that when... But all these ornithologists lost track of the bird for a few days, and they're all on pins and needles, expected the poor thing was probably dead. And then suddenly, there he is, resting up in Syria.
Yeah, that might have been the same bird, yeah. It's one of these things, birds are moving all the time. A bird never stops, you know, they're always moving around. So usually, with these satellite transmitters, if you get a reading that stays in one place for a long time, that means the bird is dead. But the bird, that particular bird, I think, made it safely to South America. Yeah. Yeah, there's a hand in the back. Yeah.
This is probably an oversimplification of the question, but when you were looking at how do the birds do it, how do they learn how to do it, how do they navigate, is mm-hmm. there any sense of, which seems like when you take the bird out of its normal, you know, you capture the bird and then you disorient it.
Yeah.
Is there, like, the leader, you know, you think of, like, the V, you know, and I've heard, like, and then the leaders will shift kind of relational into themselves.
Yeah.
wonder if you take the leader out of the equation, what happens with that?
Yeah, my understanding, at least with geese and things like that, the travel in those big Vs, like Canadian geese, you see that all the time. I may be wrong, but my understanding is that the bird in the front isn't navigating particularly, and that's one of the reasons they switch. It's mostly a matter of aerodynamics. The bird in the front is working the hardest, and all the birds that fade out in the V behind it are in some senses riding a stream. They're not just riding a stream, but they've got less air resistance. And then they switch. They take turns being the front bird because that bird is working harder.
It's like bicycle
racing. Yeah. If you're right behind a fast moving object through the air, you're not dealing with as much air resistance, right? I don't think it has to do with navigation. Someone out there might contradict me, but yeah.
And then how do they determine that? Like that idea.
Like, I've had enough. They're honking all the time. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're communicating. Yeah, I don't know.
Awesome job. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. Anyone else?
That evening warbling, is there any sense of echolocation similar to bats?
Oh, yeah. I don't think so. I think it's more communal, like, locating each other and staying together because I don't think, I mean, maybe some birds, certain birds have extremely, extremely good hearing and are able to locate, but it's not the same thing as bats. Like a barn owl, for instance, owls in general have hearing that's just completely out of this world. Everybody talks about owls having great eyesight, which they do, but a great gray owl can be perched on a tree over a field with 2 feet of snow, and it can locate a mouse under the snow. And it tilts its head and it's listening. Part of the way it does this, it has two ear holes, one that's small and one that's big, and they're out of alignment with each other. And so somehow that allows it to sort of pinpoint, triangulate the location of where a sound is coming from, like to a pinpoint. we have symmetrical ears, and human beings are very bad at pinpointing exactly where a sound is coming from, right? But a great gray owl can bust right through the snow and catch a mouse that's crawling along on the grass level. A barn owl, I think, is the only bird that can catch its prey in complete darkness, like no light at all, just based on sound. So they've done experiments in big warehouses where they will release a barn owl, and there's like a mouse on the floor on the other side of the warehouse, and the barn owl just like gets it in total darkness. Any animal has to have some light to see. Right? If it's total black, you know, no eye will do you any good. But there's that kind of precision among some birds, but I don't think it's echolocation as much as it is just precision of hearing. No. Yeah, Melissa.
Is there a correlation between, you were talking about kind of this spectrum of nearing extinction, you know, that all birds are declining, but some more than others.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, like, migration specific? Like, are the ones who have the furthest to go more likely to die off sooner, or is it just kind of...
That's a really good question. I think yes, although there may be too simple an answer. Some of the birds that are declining the fastest are the birds that migrate the furthest and are the most dependent on specific habitat along the migratory route. So birds that are, for instance, birds that hang around here all winter long, they're not depending on anything like that. I don't think they're as in steep decline. But most of the birds that are going, this is worth a fact check, actually, but I think most of the birds that are declining faster are migratory. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think birds will evolve fast enough, like, or maybe they get really low and then they learn to evolve from there to change migration patterns or find places where they don't have to migrate at all? Or do you think the state of, and I'm not saying like it's not possible, but like, is the state of humanity and what we've done too detrimental to their environment that you don't think they could recover?
I mean, it's very hard to say. I think it's dangerous to assume that birds will just adapt and find a way.
Oh yeah.
Because, like I said, the migration that we see today is a result of thousands and thousands of years of whole species adapting relationship to relative consistent conditions. And so, particularly when you think of some of the hardwired kind of whatever it is, neurological, genetic kind of thing going on with birds, it's very unlikely that that birds will adapt quickly enough to sort of bounce back to their historic numbers, I think. It's certainly not... It's possible that some birds will adapt in some ways. I mean, already, for Canada geese, some Canada geese migrate really far away, some just stick around and find ways to... sort of, there's different populations within a species that do different things sometimes. Mm. So... we may be looking at like a subspecies or a particular population within a species going extinct, and maybe there's still others that have a different life, you know, different migratory route. There's all kinds of potential answers to that, but in general, when we think of like adapting in order to survive, I don't think we should assume that the birds will be able to do that. I think we really have to think about how to, in very deliberate ways, preserve specific habitat. I mean, assuming that the birds will continue to try to depend on what they've depended on for thousands of years, and if it's not there, they're going to die. So, I think that's people that know more about. I'm sure there's a better answer.
Follow-up question, really fast.
Go ahead.
That New Jersey spot, should people just be very careful in traveling there to preserve the area?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just, like, not make
it. Yeah. Well, Cape May, New Jersey, it's interesting. I don't think it's not just a stopover site, as in a place where birds have to feed to survive. Delaware Bay, like some of the mudflats along Delaware Bay, which is nearby, are very important. But Cape May is just a spit of land that birds tend to fly through as they're migrating. So it's like a funneling kind of thing that happens. It's not necessarily the case that like birds depend on that little spot to survive. They just pass through it.
Okay.
So there's other places where they're more dependent. For instance, the hawks that are migrating through Cape May.
Yeah.
They're just kind of on their way somewhere else, but they all tend to go right past that little... Yeah. And so it's a great place to go watch them.
Would it be possible or even practical to make state parks of the places where people... where the birds go to survive? Or is it too big in an area?
I mean, that is the case in some places already.
Okay.
I'm not sure the answer to that question. I mean, the all of Delaware Bay can't be protected, probably.
Yeah.
When you're talking about international laws and stuff in the Yellow Sea in China, I'm not really sure what the political incentive is to preserve that for China. I don't know. There's all kinds of efforts of people trying to save these birds. But, you know, the efforts that people go through to kind of save the charismatic, really cute birds like the spoon-billed sandpiper, like this guy. I mean, come on, look at that bird. It's so cute. Oftentimes, the efforts that ecologists go to save one bird ends up protecting like thousands of other species, right? Because it's like an umbrella species. If you can protect the habitat for this one really charismatic, cute bird, you're actually protecting the habitat for dozens of other species of bird, which are just as dependent. And so. That's this. The spoon-billed sandpiper has become like the poster child for endangered shorebirds in China.
Like koala bears.
Yeah.
Functions.
Yeah. It's hard to get funding or to help preserve whatever some endangered mollusk. Yeah. But if you can protect the really cute fish that shares the same habitat as the mollusk, then you're going to protect everything. So the ecologists think about this kind of thing. They're like, okay, so where do we pour our energy? Into?
Yeah.
Dan.
One thing that I find somewhat encouraging is that the last ice age here wasn't that long ago in terms of thousands of years.
Like 20,000 or something, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And all the migratory patterns that you described that had anything to do with the East Coast would have been...
Since then.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it would have been totally different. Yeah.
Now, of course, we're making changes ridiculously faster than the glaciers did.
Yeah.
in the last ice age, but still, it's not as if it were millions of years.
That's true.
It's all been just very fixed.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't think there's any going back to the abundance of bird life that there was 150 years ago. The question is, how much can we preserve by slowing down the processes that we've started and enable bird populations to recover somewhat or to stop declining somewhat. I think that's I think more what we're hoping for. But it's true. What Dick mentioned is important. In terms of temperatures changing, the last ice age, 20,000 years ago, where we're standing right now is under a mile of ice. So maybe not a mile, a lot.
Hard for birds to survive.
And so obviously the bird life cycle was very different then in relationship to the landscape. But like you said, that is the rate of change is much faster than any species can just. If you're talking about evolving, the rate of change that's happening now is much faster than any species can realistically. Adapt to. Yeah. Yeah. Did Emily?
Amanda,
sorry.
Okay. I think the thing that stood out to me, I really appreciate this lecture because just your description of how amazing it is that the bird can get where it's going. It really reminded me of that passage about the birds of the air and how God cares for them.
Yeah.
And how won't he care for us so much more? That really stood out to me. And then the other thing that came to mind is I grew up on a farm in Iowa. Saw very different birds than the ones you were.
Yeah.
But we had chickens, and then we also had, my dad was an apiarist for a while, so he had beehives.
Yeah.
And the whole behavior between the bees, it's they maybe don't go as far, but it's just as fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
And how they find the nectar and the little bee dance that they do.
How they communicate to other bees about where to find the nectar. It's insane. Yeah.
It's so amazing. And how they swarm. If they have an extra queen. So anyway, all of that I think just points me back to if God can take care of all of them and how, it seems to us so random. How could they do this? How can he not take care of us and watch over us? And even in ways we don't understand. That's what stood out to me.
Yeah. It's very true. I think, those passages, Jesus says those things, every sparrow that falls, God knows. He says those things to people, to convince people that they don't need to worry, that God really, really is attending to their needs. Because look at how he treats these little creatures. And so rightly, we should interpret that as, this is Christ telling me that I don't have to be anxious for tomorrow. But implied in the whole, in Jesus' whole reasoning there is God really cares about those birds too. It's not just and the bird is trash, so think about how lucky you are. What he's saying only makes sense if God actually really cares for the each tiny bird that, that doesn't nosedive into the ocean because it doesn't have enough strength to make. So that's the other thing. If I had more time, I would have talked about that. Like his God's attention to like the tiny things. And Jesus rightly tells us, yeah, that's the case. So how much more does he care for you? It's wonderful that it's not Jesus pitting God's care for us against other creatures. Mm-hmm. It's not a zero-sum arrangement. It's like he cares so much for this. Now, like, take that as encouragement because you're actually more important than the sparrow.
Are there, do you see encouraging signs of Christians waking up to this kind of, the kind of thing you're saying? Because I, you know, you so often hear Christians just sort of debunking this kind of idea. I mean, just, being so androcentric, so seeing so much God's, you know, humanity is the height of God's creation and everything's here for us. And I mean, I think this is. There's certainly some really strong Christian voices. Creation care, the whole creation care movement is grown tremendously. It seems to me over the last 20, 30, whatever years. But are you think of someone like Catherine Cahill, mm-hmm. who's really great. But are you encouraged? Is Tim encouraged?
I don't know.
People encouraged by.
It depends where you look. You can find encouraging signs and discouraging signs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I'm able to answer that too well. I mean, you're right that there's much more of an awareness of creation care being a thing and an important thing, mm-hmm. an aspect of our life of obedience. Not just, oh, if you're a Christian and you really like nature, you can engage with this thing over here. It's like, no, I think
if you love God.
Right, yeah. But a lot of this stuff is totally gotten wrapped up into the very politically polarized conversation today where to... You know, if I'm a conservative Christian, then that means I must be conservative politically, which means I actually shouldn't care about this stuff. Or shouldn't take it seriously. And that's just very distressing. The guy Peter Harris, who some of us know, he and his wife founded an organization called Arasha back in the 70s, was it? Or 80s. In Portugal. And we have a sort of a friendship with him because Arasha and Labri have some sort of shared DNA in some ways. He thought of Arasha as, he told me when they started Arasha, they thought of it as an ecological Labri, so that they're very much about the community and people coming together, sharing life together, but also around a particular local ecological issue. So for them, it was in Portugal and they were banding birds and trying to preserve a wetland that was threatened. That was really... In that case, it was migratory birds from Europe that depend on specific wetlands on their way migrating to North Africa. So there's a whole migratory route from Europe down to Africa, like the stork. That was their whole work was a band. They established a bird banding station there and banded thousands and thousands and thousands of birds for many years. My brother Tim actually visited them there and helped them with their banding for a very short time. Just like there's Christian people that I think are really concerned and knowledgeable and sensible about a lot of this stuff. They're not always met with enthusiasm in churches. I mean, that Arasha has struggled to get a foothold in this country.
Especially here,
Going and talking to pastors about potentially supporting an organization like Arasha, and very often they're just in Peter's experience and in the guy who used to direct Arasha America years ago, Matthew Sleeth, mm-hmm. talking about how difficult it was to get pastors of American churches to care. Not necessarily hostility, but just like, yeah, that's great you're doing that, but it's not our focus is on people. You know, our focus is on, you know, trying to help people, which is good, but it's not. So much of the problem arises when we view things as a zero-sum game. Yeah. You know, we have, as if there's only so much care we have to offer and we have to prioritize people as opposed to these other things. Like, well, sometimes, obviously, you have to choose people over other things, but sometimes that comes out of a lack of recognition that a human being is an embedded creature and dependent on creation. You actually degrade and harm creation. You are definitely degrading and harming human beings at some point, but right now, usually poor people. I mean, in terms of ecological crises, this is what the people that are most affected immediately are people that don't have the financial means to buffer themselves from environmental degradation. So that's where like environmental care and people care like come together. Like if you actually care about issues of social justice, you should care about environmental issues. Yeah.
When you spoke about this stuff at the Minnesota conference, did you get lots of fairly conservative Christians in general? But did you have a really good response? Did you get pushback? Did you people?
No, I didn't get any pushback. I think I got a lot of encouragement.
Good.
I think it was a self-selecting crowd. The people that come to a talk on bird migration are probably interested in birds. There was a fairly receptive crowd.
Yes, okay.
There were some questions. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure everyone like agreed with everything I said, but that's fine. But it was definitely it wasn't dismissed by anybody. Yeah, Paul.
This is kind of reminding me of something I heard somebody say. You know, there was a bald eagle building a nest on the island. Ways down.
I saw it 2 days ago. Flew right over the road.
Well,
yeah.
Somebody commented to me that they had heard somebody say that people have a motivation not to talk about the bald eagle being there because some authorities, if the authorities find out that there's a bald eagle there, they will come in and somehow restrict or control what you're doing. What's going on with that?
That island and that whole body of water is already constricted and controlled. You're not allowed to boat or swim or do anything on it.
But,
I don't know what. Yeah.
Other places, like you know, other areas of the state or the nation or something.
Oh, like if you identify an endangered species in a place, then suddenly people aren't going to be able to just. Well, I mean, bald eagles thankfully are not on the endangered species list anymore, which is wonderful. They used to be, along with a bunch of raptors, along with osprey and peregrine falcons and everything. They were because of DDT, because of the pesticides that were completely devastating birds of prey. So since that was outlawed, a lot of those species have come back. And so bald eagles aren't as much of a sacred thing as they used to be in terms of endangered. But you do have things like piping plover. That's a little shorebird.
And that's a huge annoyance to a lot of people that want to drive their four-wheelers or whatever.
Yeah.
And they can't ever.
It is, yeah. Or even people that want to walk their dogs and have their dogs just run freely all over the beach. It's like, okay, it's nice for a dog to run freely over the beach, but is it really a huge denial of your rights to, for a particular couple weeks in the springtime, not do that? Because if your dog runs all over the beach, it will eat all the plover babies. That just happens. And so I know I have a really good friend of mine, like, is always kind of like pissed off that she can't do what she wants on the beach during those particular weeks of the year. And I'm always like, well, you know, get over it. Like, you're not, your life isn't being threatened by having to practice this little bit of self-control. But if you don't do it, this entire species is being threatened. So we can be okay with that. I think, when we actually think about the sacrifices we're making, it's not very much. It's more of the principle for some people, I think. It's like, well, I shouldn't have to.
Right.
Yeah, I shouldn't have to do that. Like, well, what if you did? Would your life be much worse?
Yeah.
Probably not. Yeah, so piping plovers are an example here. So this is a tiny little shorebird, very cute little bird that that nests... literally lays its eggs on a little hollow in the sand, and that's all. And so they're ground nesters. Their babies, when they hatch, can within a few minutes are able to run. They're like a little puffball with legs, and they run around. But they're very vulnerable, not just to people doing stuff, but like to raccoons and, like, you know, other predators are devastating on these. So certain times of year, if you go to Plum Island on the North Shore of Massachusetts, whole portions of the beach will be fenced off. It's like, you're not allowed to go there. And people get used to it, and they're fine. But the alternative is to never put the fencing up, and then those particular birds will just pretty much get ravaged every
is
year.
Is it working?
It helps. Yeah, I mean, I think it does help. You're much more likely to have broods of babies actually grow to maturity and be able to fly and get off the nest. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's all kinds of. And the thing that does bother me though is when people say like, "Whoa, what a stupid bird! It lays its eggs right on the sand." Like, what do you expect? You're like, yeah. Well, like, the bird isn't stupid. It's not intelligent by human standards. It's not supposed to do any of the things that people do. It clearly has survived for thousands and thousands of years by laying its eggs on the sand. It's just that conditions have changed rapidly and it's not able to adapt. That doesn't make it stupid. Anyway, the way people talk about animal intelligence bothers me sometimes. They're not supposed to be as smart as you. Whatever.
A lot smarter than us in some areas.
Right. Yeah. Well, Sarah.
I think this is sort of continuing down the same path. I'm thinking about the horseshoe crabs the interdependence.
Yeah.
I liked your phrase, God's creative tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
Tendency to interdependence. Stronger than a tendency, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
And on the one hand, like, it would be really nice, and I think really the hope of what it means to be made in God's image is that humans would be compelled by the interdependence of other species and see, like, take up their role as protectors,
stewards,
and lovers of God's creation. But we're selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious about what some of the other human-centered vulnerabilities are for this, like the decline of birds in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like especially with the horseshoe crab being harvested by the biomedical industry,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is for the sake of humans, presumably, to protect human life. And yet, what about human life is at stake with the decline of the bird population?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
Sort of an idea. If maybe there was a breeding thing for horseshoe crabs,
mm-hmm.
and a way to stock them appropriately,
mm-hmm.
maybe there's an intervention that could help out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that may be the case. I don't know. There'd have to be a good economic incentive to do that. The question is, like, to what degree does the plight of all these birds actually affect people in a way that hurts?
Like, it feels like such an absurd question to have to ask, you know?
Yeah.
But it does seem like, I mean, part of the rapidity of the change
mm-hmm.
is because
mm-hmm.
of just such a human centric.
Yeah.
Yes. Everything, you know,
yeah.
so like
yeah.
there's such a tunnel visioning of human
mm-hmm.
concern.
Yeah. It's a really good question. This goes for all of the questions here. Like, this is a few thoughts. There may be totally different answers out there. It's pretty hard to point to, like, a reason why the decline of the red knot specifically affects me. As a Christian, it should affect me in terms of grieving me if I actually want the world to be an abundant place like God designed it to be. But it doesn't for everybody, and it doesn't for me much of the time. So what's the, you know, people in environmental study, I remember taking an environmental studies class in high school where basically it was about all kinds of stuff, including like energy efficient stuff and using less electricity and having less of an eco footprint and all these things. And basically the theme of the course was, you can't do anything unless you find a way to make it economically better. Because people make decisions based on their pocketbook. And if you can make this, if you can invent energy-efficient house appliances that will, in the long run, save people lots of money, then maybe you can get people to start using them. And so this is the economic incentive is the only incentive.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing quite like that when it comes to like the incentive to save some random species of bird. I don't think. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be. I think it's much more likely to talk about. In a sense, human beings are the umbrella species, and if we actually cared for them, we would be protecting a lot of other things too. Because when it comes to global temperatures changing and all kinds of issues to do with environmental degradation, people are actually either affected right now or will be affected pretty terribly. And my sense is that we have a hard enough time motivating to change things based on that. Mm-hmm. But if we did, we would end up helping a lot of the birds too. Particularly in terms of like trying to slow down the rate of climate change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is if left unchecked, is definitely going to be devastating for people. But also, so it's a good, mm-hmm. it's a good question. I mean, certainly for people that love to watch birds and find mm-hmm. enjoyment from mm-hmm. engaging in creation, it's really sad to see them dwindling. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that carries enough economic sway to change global politics. I don't know, Dick, what do you think?
Yeah, that's what I keep hoping, that because in the last 20 years there's a huge increased interest in birds, mm-hmm. in birding. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking, when is this going to go over mm-hmm. into broader environmental things mm-hmm. because of all the stuff you've been talking about, because of all the interdependence. Now, maybe to build up a fantastic life list, you don't need to care.
Yeah.
If you can travel all over the world and record exotic species of birds that you see, you don't, and that's what you care about.
Yeah.
But I remember we had a student here who was a photographer for National Geographic for a while, and she worked on grizzly bears.
Oh, yeah.
And what she mentioned was that some of her best allies were duck hunters.
Yeah.
Because they it's a huge importance of environment.
Yeah.
And gravitational. I mean, not gravity, but migratory path.
Yeah.
And so she had all sorts of alliances with people who were hunters.
Yeah.
Not just duck hunters, but all sorts of hunting.
Yeah.
And contacted with people who buy hunting licenses and stuff.
Totally.
Like and who care about the environment, not just to get lots of birds, but to care about birds too.
Yeah.
In terms of their fruitfulness and so on. So I just wonder when can this, the interest in birds get widened out into different things. On that question, I remember economic viability. I remember Bill Jordan, who was a friend of ours from New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
And a biologist in New Zealand said, in New Zealand, if a scientist wants to get money for any project, they've got to show that how it helps sheep. If it doesn't help sheep, you won't get a nickel.
Just name your project whatever you want to name it, and then put "and sheep" at the end of the name.
It says anything about sheep, you've got your grant.
More sheep than people, right? Yeah.
But I mean, there's got to be ways that can be shifted sideways like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Strategically, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably, I mean, I don't have any great ideas there, but I do. It is definitely true that historically, people that are really interested in hunting and fishing have been huge motivators for environmentalism in terms of preserving habitat.
Yeah. Okay.
And it may feel like that sort of alliance between environmentalists and hunters is sort of like getting your hands dirty, but actually no. I mean, some of the people that know the most about wildlife are the people that like to hunt. So you have to know a lot, you know, so in terms of knowledge as well as motivation for wanting to preserve something.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, was a lot of the national parks we enjoy today are because he loved to shoot big animals. This is part of, maybe it was more than that, but like hunters, you know, you can't enjoy that without caring about large swaths of habitat being preserved. Otherwise, there's nothing to hunt.
Yeah. Now, what was that book again that you mentioned at first? I want to get the
one. This one is called Flight Path. This is the story about all the quirky scientists that Flight Path. I highly recommend it. It's a really fun read. is talking about all the different innovations that have led people to learn more about birds. Yeah. Maybe one more question. Yeah, Marty.
Question and a quick comment. I'm just thinking from Sarah's question. Unfortunately, I can't think of examples, but I so often do hear of just unintended consequences that of evidence that comes out that, in fact, the species really is important to human beings in ways that we just haven't known, and that you sort of see God's hand in the in the complexity of creation, the interdependence of creation,
yeah.
And that, you know, we just haven't known enough, and the sort of hubris of thinking we do, or
yeah.
of moving, remember, unintended consequences of transporting, I remember, Bermuda just got population of a whole lot of species got decimated because some birds were moved there to eat some lizards or something, and it turns out that they did. And in Bermuda, they didn't like those lizards, but they ate all sorts of other things. It was just, you know, just sort of the unintended consequences of messing with thinking that we know enough.
Hawaii is an even worse example of
really,
that.
Really.
Yeah, the stuff that's been done ecologically there has been really, really terrible. Yeah.
But I have a question. You hear back and forth periodically about wind power and birds.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any? I mean, you know, some people say no. Birds get caught in the in the wind power. Other people argue the wind power is, you know, it's really a good thing to do.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on
that? I don't know a lot about that, although I do know that some birds do get hit by those massive turbines and killed. Nowhere near as many as hit skyscrapers.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of birds. One of the things that is responsible for I'm not sure what the percentages are, what the numbers are, but a lot of nighttime flying songbirds smack into skyscrapers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
much more so than wind
too. Yeah, and I don't know how the numbers compare, but yeah, wind turbines do take a toll on some birds, but not a huge.
Right. That's
not a huge toll.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not how you weigh the benefit of wind power.
Right.
I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but my sense is that wind power overall is a really good thing.
Yeah.
But just because of the thing, the sources of energy it allows us not to use.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. But yeah, it definitely is true that wind turbines do kill some birds. Yeah.
Right.
If you think about how fast those blades are going,
yeah.
And you think about, sometimes I watch them, I'm like, can I like stick my hands through and pull it out? And it's like, the thing is, the blade is like 30 feet long, and it's going, it's like, wow, that's really fast. If you think about it, how fast it has the end of that blade is going to get around the circle, yeah, it's pretty terrifying. But yeah, so birds that fly right through the middle of that don't do well.
What you're saying, in the long run, if it's helping reduce global warming, that's helping birds and their habitats and their, you know,
so in a much more indirect way, maybe, yeah.
More indirectly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to like put a number to analyze that really, but you could definitely say that the number of birds killed by wind turbines doesn't compare to the number of birds killed by habitat destruction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not even comparison. One thing, an example of how like not understanding. Two things. Hawaii was an example of like trying to solve a problem before people understood the nature of the ecosystem, the nature of the interdependence, right? I think it had to do with there's an endangered goose that's I think it's the Hawaii state bird.
Mm.
It's a beautiful goose. It's like not very many of them. But at some point or other, there were snakes introduced onto one of the Hawaiian islands, and it's not a place where snakes should be, and it was causing all kinds of problems, and so they introduced mongoose to try to keep the snake population down, but without realizing that I
think the snake is diurnal and the mongoose is nocturnal, and the two species never literally meet. Don't see each other, but the mongoose do eat the goose eggs. So basically, it plunged the state bird into even more of a decline because the mongoose were just like predate on their eggs. And anyway, it was just kind of like, oh, just like, it's just something about the arrogance of it. It's like, oh yeah, we can just like move a couple things around and we'll fix the problem. Like you haven't looked at it yet. One interesting thing I heard, I haven't read about this, but I heard it some random program on the radio about the overhunting of beaver in the western states, particularly in the sort of Rocky Mountain watershed, and how, now this is, I'm way over my head here, but it's this random rodent that chews on trees and creates dams and slows down the flow of water running down a watershed. So regularly speaking, in the Rocky Mountains, you have snow melt and it's gushing through down these rivers, and it gets into lower ground, and basically the water runs off the landscape quite quickly. Beaver dams and beavers that are like a big population of beavers that are healthy slow the water drainage off the land a lot, which actually people were realizing played a significant role in the replenishment of the aquifers, which no one realized before. And so, because what beavers do is they literally stop the water and create these pools, which actually allow more water to leach down into the ground. Anyway, and so that was something. I was like, whoa! You don't think of like one little animal having that much of an impact, like geologically, but they did, and they do. And that's like one of the whole thing was in the context of drought, like drought prevention in the West, like some of these crazy problems with drought. You've got all this snow melt, but if it runs off the land and is in the ocean, you're not actually replenishing the underground water that you need to. So that was really interesting. I haven't, if anybody wants to fact check that, look into it and see, but I don't know the details, but that was shocking to me that like, oh, beavers? Really? They have that much of an impact on
people.
Underground water. Yeah.
It was a huge impact of economically.
Yeah.
Because early in the 18th century, that was a huge part of the economy.
Yeah. Trading beaver skin. Yeah.
Across the Northwest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes them exhausted. Much of the beaver population.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there a question over here or no?
I did.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
I just was thinking about starting with Job and like how that conversation between God and Job would be now that you have this really specific science that people doing about these really particular species. And I don't know, I guess I just wondered if you had thought on that, of how we know things with more certainty, but we know very specific things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of speaking to like these moments where God is like, I'm doing this. I did this. Mm-hmm. I know this.
Yeah.
And now we have these like more concrete like scientific proofs for more really specific things. But it's almost like we don't understand like the whole system of it. And I just was curious if you knew.
I don't think God would have to try very hard at all to ask us questions we couldn't answer. I mean, it's still, because some of the questions that he asks are where were you when I did this?
Yeah.
And we're in the same boat as Job there.
Yeah.
We maybe could answer a few of the questions about where does this, I can't even think of an example, but
How is snow made?
Yeah, we understand various things more, but like the thing I like about the quote from Job that I read at the beginning is it by your wisdom that like specifically did you plan that out?
Yeah.
Like, did you decide that was what the hawk was going to do?
Yeah.
Does the hawk listen to you about that? I mean, we're no different than Job. it's still that's what I'm saying. Like, it's still God's business. It's still His business. And we can find out about it, and we can marvel at it, and understand something more about who he is. But I think with the case of so many
right? I mean, I'm not even really a scientist. I'm an amateur naturalist. I love this kind of stuff, but like, you talk to people that really do a deep dive in their field of science, whatever it is, and it's just like, the people with any integrity are usually just like astounded by what they don't know still, right? And how much more there is to understand, and how much more the people that have done the most work are most aware of what is still unknown, right? And so there's just lots of the humility that God is trying to teach Job. It's the same humility that he's trying to teach us. I don't think we're in a different place than Job, in other words. Okay. Even though we can answer some, we can say a lot more about some of those questions.
But your topic
there's no shortage. Tonight, there's no shortage of things we can't answer.
Your topic tonight is such a good example. Yeah. No, but we still don't understand why grace. I mean, yeah. People that, what is understood is yeah. wonderful, but there's still, how did birds get created to
yeah.
be able to?
Yeah, like for instance, yeah. How did the behavior, and maybe people have great answers for this. I haven't. I just find it mind boggling. How does the behavior evolve? Like, how did birds first start migrating?
Exactly.
Incrementally, maybe further and further. Just depend. You know, like I don't know. Monarch butterflies, our former colleague Anna Friedrich had read a lot more about monarch butterflies than me, but that's a truly bizarre thing that monarchs do, because they migrate, but their migration takes place over multiple generations. So no one monarch has the whole capacity or map in its head to like get from here to here. But it's like, 3 generations later, it will have made the whole journey, and then how does that come about? how is that like a an evolutionary advantage, like a reproductive advantage? Do you know what I mean? It's like it's really. And I'm sure that there are answers for some of those questions. I'm not trying to say that, you know. I don't like sort of God of the gaps kind of arguments where you're like, well, you can't answer that, so therefore God, kind of like, because then someone answers it, and you're like, well. but there's still just, it doesn't take away from the wonder. It's just like quite amazing that any of this stuff happens.
A lot of those are things God is, you know, we talk about a causal relationship that we've discovered now. Sometimes
right.
There isn't.
Yeah.
But God is arguing that, hey, I made this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
I made it. Where have you been?
Yeah.
Well.
The hubris that somehow, if I figure out how something works, then I have cracked the mystery of it. You're like, no, you haven't. You've just observed something happening that you had nothing to do with.
That I made.
Yeah, that God made. It's a little bit like the hubris of, like, mapping the human genome. Once we do that, we'll understand who we are. We mapped the human genome. We're still pretty confused about who we are. It's like, what did we think we were going to accomplish by that? I mean, it's awesome. It's amazing. But it's like the... this is the temptation of reductionism. We want to reduce everything to totally materialistic, like, manageable categories so that once we understand that category, we can say that we understand the whole thing. But we don't. We've just reduced reality to something that we can explain so that we feel more in control. So you know what I mean? So I think that's, yeah.
But it's wonderful that God made us in his image, and God delights in human curiosity. God delights in something like that book, but the curiosity that made people try to wonder.
Yeah.
You know, to know that He's on our side. He's on the side of human curiosity and investigation. He wants us to investigate his world and delights in it the way we would delight in our children doing that.
That's one of the reasons I love this book, because it's not just a cool book about bird migration. I had a great affection for people after I finished that book. I was like, wow. These people like really wouldn't let it go. It's like, we have to find out.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Great. Yeah, Hunter.
Yeah, I was just thinking that some things are meant to be placed before us so that we always will have to think, well, God did this. And I think metamorphosis might be one of those really good examples.
Yeah. Like a butterfly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And there you are on a butterfly.
Yeah. Just really, really bizarre. Like a monarch, I wish Anna was here, she could tell more, but like basically a caterpillar, at some point or other when it's fat enough, makes this chrysalis. At some point in that stage of the chrysalis, its entire body is liquefied. It's just, it's actually just liquid in there. If you were to open it up, it's not like there's some half caterpillar, half butterfly. Like it basically like completely reconstitutes itself into a butterfly.
Yeah. It's like they're interstitial cells of two different beings.
Yeah.
I mean, the second one isn't even present.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. And I guess the thing is, for me, it's like once, you know, even if we do study something in such depth that we really do understand the mechanism that's going on, like, that's no cause for arrogance. Mm-hmm. It's like you've just understood how something works. You've understood what's going on behind what you see. But you didn't invent it. And you don't know why. You've just answered how, maybe. But you don't know unless you have some sort of theology that engages with questions like why? Why would this even, you know? So yeah, it's really, really interesting. I'm probably going to end because I'm losing my voice. Yeah.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you.